Syrian oil theft is happening with U.S.-backed forces taking oil from Syria into Iraq. The war in Yemen continues. Multiple air raids have killed over a dozen people. Also in the U.S., a winter storm has battered many states in that country. Thanks for joining us. U.S. forces have sent a convoy of vehicles carrying military equipment and tankers of Syrian oil to their bases in northern Iraq. According to local sources, over 110 vehicles, including 60 tankers, departed an oil refinery in the northern city of Hasaka, escorted by armored vehicles. Earlier this month, the U.S. military sent a large convoy of vehicles to its bases in Iraq through Syria. The U.S. has stationed its forces and equipment in eastern and northeastern Syria. Damascus has repeatedly called on the U.N. Security Council to end Washington's unsolicited military presence in the Arab country. It says the deployment is illegal, and it is aimed at stealing Syria's oil and other resources. Tim Anderson is the director of the Center for Counter-Hegemonic Studies in Sydney. He tells us why the U.S. is seeking to maintain its presence in Syria. Let's take a listen.
Yes, well, this is a regular occurrence. They are recent from the Iraq, the occupation of Iraq, and then stealing the oil, which President Trump acknowledged openly a few years ago, in a contract deal to financially support their proxy at the moment in eastern Syria, that is to say the SDF, or Qassar in Arabic. But I would like to stress that stealing the oil is not the main reason they're there. The main reason the U.S. occupation is there in eastern Syria is to divide Syria from Iraq and Iran. They're trying to control the border to keep separate, to divide and rule the independent states of the region. The U.S. is in a losing game. It knows it's in a losing game. It's been losing in Syria for at least 6 or 7 years. And in Iraq, similarly, and they've even announced some withdrawal of so-called combat troops from there, so they're pretending a withdrawal, but they've done an actual withdrawal in Afghanistan, and of course that's making all the collaborators in the region nervous. But they're trying to hang on as long as they can to divide their enemies effectively, to divide the independent states who are resisting this 8 or 9 wars in what they call a new Middle East project for the region.
The Yemeni army has launched an operation deep inside the United Arab Emirates in retaliation for its role in the Saudi-led war on Yemen. Army spokesman Yahya Sari says the scope of targets will be widened as long as aggression against Yemen continues. The attacks come days after the military and its allied Ansarullah forces foiled an attack by UAE-backed mercenaries in Marib province. The latest developments might change the equation of the war in favor of Sana'a.
The Yemeni army and its allied Ansarullah forces have hit the heart of the United Arab Emirates, with officials in Abu Dhabi confirming 2 fire incidents near storage facilities of an oil firm and the city's international airport. It came just days after the Yemeni army repelled an attack by Emirati-backed mercenaries in the province of Ma'rib, killing and injuring dozens. In a statement, the Yemeni army says Monday's attack inside the UAE was a warning to stop its involvement in the Saudi-led war on the country. Earlier this month, the Yemeni army released footage of a captured UAE-flagged vessel, which had trespassed into the country's territorial waters. Army spokesman Yahya Sari said the ship was carrying military equipment and was engaged in hostile acts against Yemen. The UAE joined the Saudi-led coalition in 2015 in order to reinstate a friendly regime in Yemen. In April 2018, the Emirates deployed its military to Socotra, an island that overlooks the strategic Bab el-Mandab Strait, a main shipping route connecting the Red Sea to the Gulf of Aden and the Arabian Sea. 2 weeks later, Saudi troops were also deployed there, a move the Yemenis described as a coup against legitimacy. The UAE had largely scaled down its military presence in Yemen in 2019, but continued funding, arming, and training mercenaries in support of separatists in southern Yemen. It became quite clear when forces loyal to former Yemeni government, aided by UAE-backed brigades and Saudi warplanes, reclaimed the oil and gas-rich southern province of Shabwa earlier this month. and made advances toward Ma'rib province. However, the Yemeni army's repeated retaliatory drone and missile attacks inside Saudi Arabia and now in the UAE show the coalition is losing the momentum. It has also inflicted heavy losses on Saudi and Emirati-backed militias operating inside the country. Since last year, the Yemeni army, along with Ansarullah forces, have liberated nearly 20,000 square kilometers of land in several large-scale operations. Nearly 7 years of bombing campaigns and blockade on Yemen have proved fruitless for Saudi Arabia and some of its regional and international allies, including the U.S., as they fail to achieve their intended goals. On the other hand, Yemen's armed forces and the popular comedies have grown stronger against the invaders and give them crushing response to their deadly mayhem in the impoverished nation.
The Saudi-led military coalition has stepped up its airstrike campaign against Yemen, targeting many areas across the war-torn country. Saudi warplanes targeted the parliament building as well as a military academy in the capital Sana'a. At least 12 people, including women and children, have been killed and nearly a dozen injured. Reports say the Saudi-led coalition has also carried out more than 50 airstrikes across Yemen over the past day. The strikes have targeted the provinces of Shabwa, Jauf, Hajjah, Hodeidah, and Ma'rib, among others. Saudi Arabia, along with its regional allies, launched a devastating war on its southern neighbor 7 years ago in a bid to reinstate a Riyadh-friendly regime. Hundreds of thousands of Yemenis, mostly civilians, have been killed and millions displaced since then. Activist and political commentator Hussein Al-Bukhaiti says Saudi attacks in civilian neighborhoods demonstrate its failure in targeting military positions.
I think this latest attack against Abu Dhabi is a clear message to United Arab Emirates that it should end and stop its involvement and its war and blockade on Yemen. And as you mentioned, United Arab Emirates depend, as an example, on 95% from oil production and as well from foreign companies that are working in Abu Dhabi and as well Dubai. So if Yemeni army will continue to target areas in United Arab Emirates, I believe that those companies and those oil firms will leave the country. I mean, that's why we have seen that the latest strike on Sana'a, it shows the failure of United Arab Emirates to target a Yemeni army in Shabwa or in Ma'rib. I mean, they could, instead of launching those airstrikes on civilians in central Sana'a, one of the busiest area in Sana'a, instead, why they haven't launched those attacks in the battlefield? Why they haven't wasted those missiles that cost tens of thousands of dollars to kill civilians? In that latest attack, they have killed 12 civilians, including one entire family of Abdullah Al-Junaid, including his children. Eight civilians were injured, and it's been reported that 12 civilians are still missing. That's why the number of casualty could rise up by the morning.
Palestinians in the Gaza Strip have held a protest rally in front of the Red Cross office to show their solidarity with the Palestinian inmates in Israeli jails. The protesters called on the international community to take practical steps to save the lives of inmates held in Israeli jails with no charge or trial. Yuva Shabit has more from Gaza.
Islamic and national forces in the Gaza Strip held a demonstration in front of the Red Cross headquarters in solidarity with Palestinian prisoners held under administrative detention in Israeli jails. The protest comes as hundreds of inmates have already boycotted Israel's military court, demanding an end to its illegal administrative detention. About 500 administrative detainees began the new year by refusing to show up for their court sessions.
Israeli regime has renewed administrative detention against hundreds of Palestinian inmates. Palestinians and human rights groups should do their best to put an end to the cruel policy. We stand by our brothers in Israeli jails who have boycotted Israel's military court. We also call on international human rights organizations to take a serious action.
The boycott of Israel's military court by Palestinian inmates comes as the health of the Palestinian hunger striker Nasser Abu Hamid is deteriorating. He has been in a coma for 11 days while in custody. Palestinian factions say the intentional medical negligence practiced by Israeli regime aims at killing the Palestinian prisoners.
Our message is clear. We will always support our detainees who stand against the brutal policies of the Israeli regime. Our brother Nasser Abu Humaid is in coma for 11 days due to medical negligence as Israel refuses to release him to provide him with proper medication. This amounts to a criminal act against our prisoners.
Public protests are mounting day by day against Israel's decision not to release Nasser Abu Humaid. Palestinians say they will hold Israel accountable if the inmate dies.
About 500 Palestinian detainees are refusing to show up for their court sessions, saying that this move is aimed at putting an end to the illegal Israeli administrative detention policy. They are also demanding the release of the hunger-striking prisoner Nasser Abu Humaid, who's on the verge of death. Ruba Shabet, Gaza.
In the United States, thousands of flights are canceled to the eastern part of the country amid a heavy snowstorm. More than 4,200 flights have been canceled due to the winter storm, which has left about 120,000 homes and businesses without power. Two people died in North Carolina when they lost control of their car in the snow. According to the National Weather Service, the storm could drop another 20 to 30 centimeters of snow in parts of Vermont, New Hampshire, and Maine as it heads north to Canada's Quebec and Ontario. An extreme weather warning is in effect for much of southeastern Canada. Brent crude oil prices hitting their highest level in more than 7 years amid optimism for a growth in demand. The price of each barrel has gone past $87. This is in part due to a failure by OPEC and other key producers to meet targets to lift output by 400,000 barrels a month. Also, news of the possibility of the Omicron variant building herd immunity in societies has made investors more optimistic about an increase in global demand. So far this year, oil has rallied more than 10%, and investment firms are forecasting that this trend will continue, saying the prices could exceed $100 next year for the first time since 2014. Steve Keen, author of the New Economics Manifesto, joins us to perhaps explain this to us. Steve Keen, so we're looking at either the possibility or for it to actually be a reality of an increase in demand. Putting aside the fact that Omicron is somewhat subsiding and, you know, herd immunity taking place. But the unwillingness of OPEC to increase production, is it a unwillingness or is it because they want to keep the price high? And that's what their goal is by not increasing production.
Well, it's the latter with OPEC because, you know, it's always been about trying to maintain the price of oil. And, yes, that's probably the major motivation. But at the same time, of course, we've seen the supply chain impact that COVID has had on manufacturing production in China, and there's no reason to expect it wouldn't have a similar impact in the oil-producing countries with the difficulty of hiring, getting staff involved. You need workers per machine, so if a lot of your workers are off work because of COVID, then you're not going to be able to produce that same volume. So it'd be a combination of the two factors.
All right. We had the U.S. that asked OPEC, this is going back a few months, in which they wanted the production to get to increase. That did not happen. Even their friend at OPEC, Saudi Arabia, did not really comply with that. At the same time, you have a country like Iran that can easily fulfill whatever shortages, at a minimum, for them to supply the market with. But the U.S. sanctions are preventing that from happening. At what cost is this coming?
Well, America is very good at shooting itself in the foot, so that's partly what they're doing by, you know, oppressing Iran in the same way they oppress Cuba. You'd think they'd finally give up after all the years of useless policy in the Middle East, but they never seem likely to. But I think we have to keep in mind that we are reaching, I believe, the end of fossil fuels. We've totally ignored the impact that fossil fuels have on carbon dioxide, which is crazy because that's where most of it comes from. And I think we're reaching potentially the end game with the level of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere right now. So at some point, it won't be America forcing us to shut down oil production. It will be the rest of the world saying we simply can't afford the climate effects of this increasing level of carbon dioxide. And that means that ultimately an end to fossil fuels.
Yeah, we had that push as one of the core pillars, so to speak, of what happened with the climate change conference that that was recently held. But at the same time, the commitments that were given, Saudi Arabia 60 or 70 years down the road, including India, and not really getting a tangible motion towards the elimination of fossil fuels. Do you think that fell short in that sense?
Oh, of course. We don't want to end fossil fuel production because so much wealth, particularly of Saudi Arabia, but also and the oil giant corporations themselves, the coal companies and so on, it's tied up in continuing to exploit that free resource, which, you know, sunshine that fell on the planet 100 million years ago. And we're ignoring the damage done to the climate. We're saying it's in the level of percentages of GDP sometime in the distant future. I think that's completely fallacious. The work I've done looking at what economists have done on climate change shows their numbers are just ridiculous, massively underestimating the impact.
Thank you for that, Steve Keen, author of the New Economics Manifesto. The UK government's so-called police and crime bill has created a lot of controversy over the past days. Now the upper chamber of parliament has moved to block the highly divisive bill. The House of Lords voted against or amended almost every part of the bill. The proposed legislation includes sweeping stop-and-search powers for police, banning protests at key public venues, and criminalizing nonviolent protest tactics, among them the obstruction of traffic. The legislation was earlier passed in the House of Commons, but it triggered mass protests in England and in Wales. Critics argue that it impinges on citizens' right to assembly, the freedom of expression, and other civil liberties. The lower chamber should now vote on the amended version. And that does it for World News. This is bye-bye for now.
This is IRIB English Radio. With you early in the morning. With you at midday. With you till the night's end. IRIB English Radio.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد میشید به تخت اعلی.
In the path of the Imam.
In the name of God, the compassionate and the merciful, salam and welcome to the program. If you remember, we discussed Imam Khomeini's recommendations on political groups, especially MKO terrorist organization, and said that he had advised all terrorist groups to return back to the ocean of the Iranian nation and stop acts of terror to satisfy their masters in the West or the East. In this episode, we are going to touch upon his stance on leftist and separatist groups. Stay tuned, please. Concurrent with the victory of the Russian Revolution of 1917 and coming to power of a communist ideology in the country, leftist thoughts grew in many countries, particularly in the neighbors of Soviet Union, including Iran. Though the religious fabric of Iran and the sensitivity of the ruling system never led them to spread much among masses. Today Party was the most important organized group among the leftist groups which came to existence in Iran after the Second World War. This party was eradicated in two phases. First, after the assassination attempt against the Shah in Tehran University, and then in the post-1953 coup period. Thus, its leaders and advocates escaped or were tortured or executed. A few of them also turned into spies of the regime through the pressures and temptations of the Shah agents. In 1960s, due to the increase of partisan struggles inspired by the thoughts of Che Guevara, Mao and Castro, and closure of political climate in Iran, some youth and students started armed struggles against the Shah. They intended to spread armed and partisan struggles to the whole society, a la China and Cuba, to topple the regime. But the Shah regime was fully supported by the U.S. As a result, the members of such groups would soon be identified and repressed before taking any serious measure. These groups were totally destroyed in late 1960s and early 1970s. At that time, the regime of Mohammad Reza Pahlavi was in its most powerful days, thanks to the exorbitant oil revenues and relying on security and military support of the U.S. and allies. In such circumstances, Imam Khomeini started his struggle against the Shah and the U.S. with trust in God and relying on people's all-out support. Millions of men and women from all walks of life answered positively to Imam Khomeini's call to show their opposition to the regime of Shah. Therefore, they poured to the streets and chanted anti-regime slogans. The Imam's all-encompassing umbrella had indeed covered all political parties and every social stratum. Thus, the Islamic Revolution triumphed in a few months to the bewilderment of all analysts. Without doubt, the key element in this victory was the unmatched personality of Imam Khomeini and his charismatic leadership. The course of the revolution left no choice for political parties but to join the masses, even if they didn't believe in the ideology and ideals of the Imam and the people. This was the means for most of them to survive. The leftist groups had no belief in Islam, but had to join the people to survive. However, after the victory, they started to act as opposition and counter-revolutionary elements. They left no stone unturned to hurt the Islamic Revolution. Imam Khomeini time and again advised them to return to the Islamic Revolution and the Iranian nation. But they insisted on their stubborn thoughts and were finally exterminated. The Imam writes in his testament, "My recommendation to the leftists, like communists and Fadaye Khalq partisans and other groups with leftist tendencies, is that without proper studying of ideologies and the ideology of Islam, with those who are well aware of ideologies, especially Islam, which motive has satisfied you to be inclined to the ideology that has failed in the world today, and what has happened that you have become content with few isms, whose content is null with researches, What has motivated you to intend to draw your country to the lap of the Soviet or China and to fight your nation in the name of love of two-day party or hatch plots to the benefit of foreigners against your country and oppressed masses? Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon him, addressing leftist groups, writes in his testament, "You can see that since the onset of communism, its masqueraders have been the most dictatorial, the most power-seeking, and the most monopolist governments in the world. What nations were smashed and annihilated under the rule of the Soviet, claiming to support masses? The Russian nation, Muslims and non-Muslims, have been struggling with twitches under the pressure of the Communist Party and are denied any freedom and are living in suffocation worse than that of the world dictators. Stalin, who was one of the so-called bright figures of the party, we were witness to his coming and going and his protocols and aristocracy. Now that you, the Beagle, are sacrificing your life for that regime, the oppressed people of the Soviet and its satellites like Afghanistan are dying of their oppressions." Imam Khomeini continues to advise the leftist, "You who are claiming the advocacy of people, what crimes you have committed against these people wherever you could, as with the noble people of Amol, who you wrongly called your strong advocates and sent many of them deceptively to fight people and the government to be killed. You want to offer the Iranian oppressed and deprived nation to the Soviet dictatorship, and you are doing this treason under the guise of Fadai-e Khalq and advocates of the deprived. The Two-Day Party and its cohorts are doing this through conspiracy under the mask of supporting the Islamic Republic, while other groups are doing it through arms, terror, and lies." Imam Khomeini writes in continuation, "I write as testament to you parties and groups, either those who are known as leftists or those who are feeding from and inspired by the West, or even those such as Democratic or Komole parties who take arms in the name of autonomy and advocacy of Kurds and Baluch, and have destroyed the deprived people of Kurdistan and other places, and prevent cultural, hygiene, and economic services and reconstruction by the government on those provinces to join the nation. Now that they have experienced that they have done nothing and cannot do anything but making the inhabitants miserable, so it is to their benefit and that of the nations and regions to assist the government and give up rebellion, serving the foreigners, and betrayal of their country. They should embark on building the country and be sure that Islam is better for them than both the criminal Western Pole and the dictatorial Eastern Pole, and it will fulfill the humane wishes of people better."
Bring us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of internet.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to the Spotlight. I'm Kabat Ahmed. On Saturday, the Yemeni army issued a warning against the UAE, one of the partners in the Saudi alliance in the war on Yemen. The United Arab Emirates, UAE, should await a harsh response for its escalations against Yemen. It reminded the Persian Gulf country that Abu Dhabi's fragile glass towers are, quote, easy to reach. That reach was executed just 2 days later. Yemen's army launched drone attacks deep inside the UAE. In this edition of the Spotlight, we will look at whether the UAE and Saudi Arabia, for that matter, will change course in this war or continue with their failed offensives.
The Yemeni army and its allied Ansarullah forces have hit the heart of the United Arab Emirates, with officials in Abu Dhabi confirming two fire incidents near storage facilities of an oil firm and the city's international airport. It came just days after the Yemeni army repelled an attack by Emirati-backed mercenaries in the province of Ma'rib, killing and injuring dozens. In a statement, the Yemeni army says Monday's attack inside the UAE was a warning to stop its involvement in the Saudi-led war on the country. Earlier this month, the Yemeni army released footage of a captured UAE-flagged vessel, which had trespassed into the country's territorial waters. Army spokesman Yahya Sari said the ship was carrying military equipment and was engaged in hostile acts against Yemen. The UAE joined the Saudi-led coalition in 2015 in order to reinstate a friendly regime in Yemen. In April 2018, the Emirates deployed its military to Socotra, an island that overlooks the strategic Bab el-Mandab Strait, a main shipping route connecting the Red Sea to the Gulf of Aden and the Arabian Sea. 2 weeks later, Saudi troops were also deployed there, a move the Yemenis described as a coup against legitimacy. The UAE had largely scaled down its military presence in Yemen in 2019, but continued funding, arming, and training mercenaries in support of separatists in southern Yemen. It became quite clear when forces loyal to former Yemeni government, aided by UAE-backed brigades and Saudi warplanes, reclaimed the oil and gas-rich southern province of Shabwa earlier this month and made advances toward Ma'rib province. However, the Yemeni army's repeated retaliatory drone and missile attacks inside Saudi Arabia and now in the UAE show the coalition is losing the momentum. It has also inflicted heavy losses on Saudi and Emirati-backed militias operating inside the country. Since last year, the Yemeni army, along with Ansarullah forces, have liberated nearly 20,000 square kilometers of land in several large-scale operations. Nearly 7 years of bombing campaigns and blockade on Yemen have proved fruitless for Saudi Arabia and some of its regional and international allies, including the U.S., as they fail to achieve their intended goals. On the other hand, Yemen's armed forces and the popular comedies have grown stronger against the invaders and give them crushing response to their deadly mayhem in the impoverished nation.
Our guest joining us for this edition of the Spotlight, we have activist and political analyst Hossein Al-Hukaiti joining us from Sana'a. Also joining us, journalist and political analyst Elijah Magnier, joining us from Brussels.
This is the Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
I'd like to welcome to you both, and Hossein Abouqaiti, let me first start with you. You had a warning that was issued by the Yemeni army, and then two days later, Abu Dhabi was hit. Drone attacks deep inside the UAE, three fuel tankers in this incident, and it took place in your storage facilities of the ADNOC, which is the oil firm of the UAE. Tell us how significant this is, and tell us why the Yemeni army decided to choose this time for it to execute this attack.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. They have chosen this time because the United Arab Emirates have declared a long time ago that they have withdrawn from Yemen and they are not involved in the war. But actually, in the recent week, United Arab Emirates has extended its attack and its strike on Yemen. They have resumed their attack, hundreds of airstrikes targeted Yemeni civilians in Shabwa region. And United Arab Emirates' role in Yemen is no different than Saudi Arabia. But on the top of that, they actually supporting separatists. They're trying to divide Yemen, controlling Yemeni island and some of the coast of Yemen, building air base there. So United Arab Emirates' goal is to divide Yemen, and then they will try to be, or they are actually a tool of the United States and the Zionist state of Israel. What's new about this latest attack on the United Arab Emirates? That comes after 3 or 4 days after Yemeni official here in Sana'a have warned United Arab Emirates if they are not going to stop their attack, that they will be under a target. And as Yahya Sari', the spokesperson of Yemeni army, he have declared United Arab Emirates as unsafe state, and he has as well called foreign company to leave the country, because at one point Yemeni army will target Abu Dhabi airport directly and will target many industrial area in United Arab Emirates. We have seen that United Arab Emirates has admitted that attack, because I believe they could not hide it as they did when Yemeni forces many 3 years ago have targeted Abu Dhabi airport. United Arab Emirates have denied at that time, but then Sana'a has released CCTV footage from the airport that shows that attack. And this is the first time Yemeni army used a ballistic missile to target, as they say, Abu Dhabi airport and Dubai airport, including as well refinery and other sensitive and important area in United Arab Emirates. That's why I believe that United Arab Emirates is still hiding some of the damage that has been done today by Yemeni attack.
Sure, that has actually been reflected in some media outlets. But Elijah Magner, our guest, talked about how one of the reasons, anyways, for the attack is that the UAE announced a few years back, a couple years ago, that it was withdrawing from the war in Yemen. That its strategy in that war has changed, and it announces the end of its direct military engagement there. Why do you think that the UAE would do that and yet continue with this war while it's still evident that it's participating, and at the same time it was at least covered in a way where it said it was a fatal blow to its relationship to Saudi Arabia?
This is a very good question. Actually, the Emirates have said that in the past, and not only after the attack on the Emirates. We saw the Stockholm Agreement coming out in 2018, establishing a ceasefire and redeployment of forces because they were critical to each humanitarian crisis. The second point of the Stockholm Agreement was the opening humanitarian corridor to allow to facilitate the freedom of movement of civilian and goods. And the last point is the prisoner swap. So nothing has changed. We haven't seen any, well, very little of prisoner swap, and we've seen very little of ceasefire, redeployment of forces, and humanitarian corridor. The siege is still established against Yemen, and the Emirates did not respect the Stockholm Agreement, and it's pushed by the Saudis to continue the war because the Saudis insist, notwithstanding all the losses they on the Saudi economy, and on losing on the ground with all its mercenaries. So because the Emirates jumped in again, then the Houthis warned the Emiratis that this is a price for what you're going to do. Mm-hmm. And the Houthis' warning was very serious. We've seen it today, but what is very surprising is how the world jumped on one attack against the Emirates when on the same day there were 38 attacks from the Saudis and coalition against Yemen. So there is really nothing that is balanced on the mainstream media, and the war in Yemen is looked at from only one angle, against the Yemeni,
sure,
and in favor of the Saudis. At the end of the day, the Saudis and Yemeni are occupying Yemen. They should leave.
Well, that's a very good point that you make. The fact that you have 38 attacks take place. Listen to Bokhesi, our guest, talking about that. That's not covered, where you have this one attack and you have a blitz of media coverage on this. Do you think that is because of the fact that UAE is small? It's a haven for what you have, the presence of foreign investors, real estate sectors, and basically port exports, and all different foreigners and expats in that small island. You have the world somewhat engaged in one way or another with that island, and that is why you have the coverage that you have, which at this point, this particular attack may actually threaten overall its economy.
Yes, I mean, if you see that United Arab Emirates, its economy and its industry, its focus on Dubai and Abu Dhabi. That's why I believe if Yemeni army will continue its attack, United Arab Emirates will be affected more than Saudi Arabia, because we know the size of Saudi Arabia is big, and as well, United Arab Emirates depend 95% of its economy on the export of oil, and the other 5% is on tourists, and there are millions of foreigners who live in United Arab Emirates, tens of thousands of foreign company. That's why we have seen as well, if you check the so-called flight radar app, you're going to see there are less flight on United Arab Emirates. Just 1 hour ago, there were two flights, one from Doha and one from Istanbul, has actually directed its flight away from Abu Dhabi Airport, and this means that the damage that has been done to the airport, and maybe the companies and flight companies will think again to use that airport and as well Dubai Airport. That's why I believe more attack against United Arab Emirates, against its airport, against its economy, it will bring it to its knee faster than Saudi Arabia, and then Yemeni army will be actually able to liberate more areas in Yemen. And just one final thing, I have seen in many media, outside media especially, they call that today attack as an escalation. They have forgot that Yemen is under attack for more than 7 years. Hundreds of thousands of Yemeni civilians has been killed. The blockade, the constant attack on Yemeni industry, on Yemeni infrastructure. That's why we have come to a point, an eye for an eye. But even though Yemeni army is still careful in taking and deciding when to attack, and there was about 10 minutes ago, two airstrikes on Sana'a. That's why I believe the coming days we will see more attack against United Arab Emirates if they are not going to stop their war against Yemen.
Well, okay, I guess we do need to talk about this, Elijah Magnier. I mean, our guest makes a very good point. You have a country that's being bombed rather continuously in the past 3 weeks. It has escalated this bombing campaign by Saudi Arabia and the Saudi-led coalition. And not to mention the past years that the country is experiencing not only the bombing campaign, civilian deaths, but the humanitarian aspect. But scant coverage, not only on that aspect of it, but the way that it gets twisted, as if this one attack that took place today is heightening or escalating the war. So the media is trying to twist this story towards the other side, isn't it?
Yes, of course. I mean, let's start from the Biden administration, when President Biden came to power and said he wants to stop the war in Yemen. And then he backed off on that, and he's no longer concerned about stopping the devastating war on Yemen and the huge, biggest ever humanitarian crisis that hit the country. Now, we see how the media is dealing with Yemen as the unforgotten war, and suddenly everybody remembers it when there is one or two or a dozen of attacks against Saudi Arabia or the Emirates, and they don't see the hundreds of attacks that are hitting Yemen for the last 7 years. That's really the way mainstream media is dealing with it, because they don't want to upset Saudi Arabia, because there is a lot of money involved from the Saudi in different countries, and because we see the United States, Canada, Germany, France, Italy, they all supplying Saudi Arabia with weapons to be used only against Yemen, because this is the only place that the Saudis are using their weapons, and they are very much aware of it, but they don't speak about it because they don't want to be involved in this humanitarian crisis, hiding behind their finger, not knowing that they are indeed responsible for every single crime against humanity that is committed in Yemen.
Well, we need to break this open in terms of the UAE role played in this war in Yemen, Hossein al-Bukhaiti. We know that it is part of the Saudi-led coalition at this point, involved in the bombing in one form or another. But there is another role that the UAE is playing that Saudi Arabia does not like. Break that open for us if you can. And that is how the UAE supports the Southern Transitional Council and its fighters, as opposed to the way that you have Saudi Arabia support what they call Yemen's President Rabah Mansour Hadi, which is not the case. Yemenis actually don't accept him or hold him legitimate. What is going on there? Why has there been a divergence there when it comes to the UAE and Saudi Arabia, particular about the Southern Transitional Council?
The United Arab Emirates is a direct toll of United Kingdom, and we know that United Kingdom, it was occupying south of Yemen. That's why they have now more interest in the country. And as they say in England, or when they conquer in Yemen or other country, they say divide and conquer. And this is exactly what the United Arab Emirates is doing. United Arab Emirates' role in Yemen is more dirtier than Saudi Arabia, because, if you were going to look at least Saudi, it says that support the so-called Hadi legitimacy, which is they call him as the president of Yemen. But on the other hand, we see that the United Arab Emirates is supporting those separatists. They are building airport. They are misusing and damaging Yemeni port. They are actually stealing fish from Yemen. They are stealing everything, especially as an example in Socotra. This means that they are actually want this war. They want to stay in Yemen. They want to divide Yemen, and as well they are fighting the so-called legitimacy or Hadi that they the many times in Aden and other areas they have fought. They have used Al-Qaeda, they have used ISIS. So the role, if it's not like Saudi Arabia, actually is more, they are more involved in Yemen. And we've seen the amount of weapons that was handed by United Arab Emirates to the so-called the separatists in south of Yemen. That's why I believe if Yemeni army will extend its attack, especially against United Arab Emirates, I'm sure that United Arab is so weak, and it will bring it to its knee, and it will stop the war against Yemen. And we have seen those many condemnation today against this attack show you that over 200,000 airstrike on Yemen, there isn't any single condemnation, especially from the United Nations or any other country. Even though, we remember when they targeted the funeral hall in Sana'a, killing more than 1,000 Yemeni civilians and injuring more than 1,000 Yemeni civilians, United Nations has called it an incident. That's why Yemeni army should step its attack despite what kind of condemnation coming from country who actually selling weapons to United Arab Emirates and Saudi Arabia.
Sure, but I need to have Elijah Magner, you tell us about what is perhaps or most arguably one of the most underreported aspects of this war, and that is the goal that the UAE has had on Socotra Island, taking that over and then bringing on, after the formal announcement of this so-called normalization of ties with Israel, bringing Israel on board, making that island in what was reported to be a spying center. But aside from that, how that's going to connect that part, which is very strategic, to other ports, for example, in Africa, with Israel on the UAE's back. Tell us the relationship there that exists between the UAE, Israel, and the purpose Socotra Island and the ports serve for whatever intentions they have.
This is absolutely a very good question. Indeed, the role of the Emirates has been very noticed in the last years since the normalization with Israel and the intensive relationship that came to the surface. However, this relationship is not new. So what the Emiratis are doing in Yemen is really to protect the navigation and the interests of the Israelis in the island of Socotra and also on Bab el-Mandeb, because they are supporting 100% the Zionist regime, and they are acting on behalf of the interests of Israel in the Middle East and elsewhere. So if you look at the Emiratis per se, they have no interest in being in Yemen or expanding their forces and their presence to create an area of influence, because this is not a big country. It's a very small country based on a bit of business and wealthy people there. Mm-hmm. They have oil, and that's their role. And now they've taken upon the role of being the the shield for the Israelis and the avant-garde of the Israeli interests in the Middle East, to really race any other country in the area of supporting Israel, hence their presence in Yemen for that purpose. And we see the visit they are coming, they are holding with the Iranians, thinking that they can compensate of their relationship with Israel. Well, the Iranians said it clearly, if you want to stop the war in Yemen, you have to go and talk to the Yemeni, accept a ceasefire and lift the siege and get out of the country, because this is not your country and you're occupying it. And it seems now with the Yemeni attack, perhaps the Emiratis got the message, and maybe it will serve them for another couple of years and stay away, as they've done after the Stockholm Agreement when they were bombed by the Houthis.
Okay, last question, Hossein Abukhaiti. Did the UAE get the message, as our guests there said? Less than a minute.
With you, I don't think they will get the message, because today attack Yemeni forces have tried, I think, to avoid, as an example, to target the industrial site in Abu Dhabi directly, or as well to target the oil field. There are a huge oil field like the so-called Zakam, and as well Bu Hasa and others. If Yemeni army, if United Arab Emirates will continue its war, I believe that those major oil sites will be under attack. And after that, United Arab Emirates and their reputation around the world as a hub for international companies will be destroyed. But we still, if they're going to do that and they're going to stop, there will be no more attack. But I don't think they will do that. Only if Yemeni will hit hard inside United Arab Emirates.
Thank you. Thank you for that. We're fresh out of time. Hossein Abukhaiti from Sana'a there, activist and political analyst. Many thanks. And Elijah Magnier, thank you for your contribution from Brussels, journalist and political analyst. And that does it for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikoa Tahwe and the entire team, it's goodbye until next time.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuhu, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is your host Musa Al-Bahadili, and you are now listening to the program Q&A on Islamic Beliefs. Joining us in the studio today is our dear friend and esteemed guest speaker, Sayyid Muhsin Naqwi, who is an Islamic researcher at the Seminary of Qum. Dear Sayyid, I welcome you and assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
Sayyid, our question today is about theological beliefs and also logic. If we employ logic, we can very easily answer this question. The poser of this question says, are turbas, praying tablets, clay tablets that Shia Muslims mostly pray on, idols? And by extension, is prostrating on these turbas, idol worship, in other words, polytheism? And do we have any narrations regarding the use of turbas?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Well, according to the Shia beliefs that we have and the narrations that we have, in order to prostrate or do sajda, we have some conditions. Number one, there are like seven parts of the body should be on the earth. That's the first thing. When it is said on the earth, it means like it should touch the ground.
Right.
The second thing is about the sajda, basically, like where you need to place your forehead.
That's the most important part.
Yeah, it is said that anything that you eat or you wear, anything that we eat or wear, we cannot place our forehead on it.
Right.
This is the main thing, the main reason of not prostrating or doing sajda on a carpet or a mat, praying mat. Okay,
why it is not clothing?
Why the needs that you use? Obviously, it's made of what is it made of? Wool,
right?
Plastic, yeah.
Right.
So all these things are used in the clothing. Your clothes, when we wear clothes, we use
it. Right.
On the other hand, you know, the things that we eat, we cannot use them as well. What is left is anything which you do not eat and anything which is not the part of clothing. That's the first thing. Therefore, we use wood. We use leaves which are not
everything
eatable.
Everything that grows from the ground,
yeah,
from the earth.
The wood, the leaves of the trees which are not used for eating. We use the straws. Obviously, the hasir is a, you know, a kind of mat which is made of straws, basically.
Right. Which grows from the ground.
Which grows. So technically, when we talk about this thing, we say anything which grows from the ground, you can do sajda on
which
it.
Which is not edible.
And
used for clothing.
It's not, yes. It's not used, it is not edible and it's not used for the clothing. So you can do this. That's the first thing. Now, the main part is anything that grows from the earth, naturally. This is the main issue. This is the main point. That, for example, if there is something, if we have a place where there is some cement, you cannot prostrate on the cement. It's not a natural thing which is grown by the earth.
Right. You know, it is man-made, this cement.
It's a man-made ahsantum. And obviously the mats that are made of plastics.
Also man-made.
Man-made. So it's not naturally been grown from the earth.
Right.
So we talk about something which has been naturally grown from the earth, and we do not make any change into its actual essence. You know, maybe from the straws we can make a mat,
right,
but the straw itself has its own...
It is still a straw mat.
It is still a straw.
Right.
The piece of wood, we can cut it into small pieces, but the wood is wood.
It's still
it's
wood.
Not been processed to something else. You know, the actual essence of the wood has been not changed. Similarly, clay. You can make a hard clay, you know, the shapes that we have, for example, turba that we have, which we use.
Right.
You can change it, but the clay is clay. It's
right.
not been like, not been changed to anything else.
It's not suddenly a statue or an idol.
Yeah.
Right.
So basically, that's the main thing we can say thing that we have. On the other hand, in the Ahlus Sunnah, they say like we can pray or prostrate anywhere we can do. We have a hadith from the Prophet ﷺ in which he said, "Sallu kama ra'aytumuni salli."